is a half-term break with a meeting with the French bank. We've got to sign our documents to apply for our right to farm. I guess we started talking seriously about it around Christmas time and found some good agents in France who've been extremely helpful. It's not the easiest thing to buy a big farm in France, but yeah, we've found a way.
British farming family quits the UK to go farming in France, saying they feel more valued by the French government than they do here in England. A major genetic breakdown is confirmed in yellow rust resistant wheat, and pork sales soar as Madame Tussauds Waxworks Museum in London celebrates National Sausage Roll Day. Welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broom.
All that and more coming up, but first, funding for nature-friendly farming is set to be slashed in the government's June spending review. That's according to an exclusive report in the Guardian newspaper, which says agri-environment support will be cut for all but a few smaller farms. Now, DEFRA's refused to comment on the report, which has caused consternation among farming leaders. And we're joined on the line now by Phil Stocker, Chief Executive of the National Sheep Association. Phil, welcome to the Farmers Weekly podcast. It just seems to be one thing after another at the moment when it comes to funding cuts for farmers.
It does, actually. It is just relentless at the moment. And I think it's verging on becoming a bit chaotic, to be honest. You know, I think we're risking really destroying any trust that might be left between farmers and DEFRA at the moment, a trust that has been, there's a lot of effort been put into trying to build that trust over this last 5 or 6 years or so. I felt we were getting somewhere, to be honest. And, you know, I think it's just, it's melting away as we speak, really.
Phil, look, in the context of what's been floating around this week and, you know, drastic cuts to support, a lot of your sheep sector colleagues were probably up against it as it is with, you know, changes to upland stuff, changes to HLS, changes to SFI. If there is no support, where does that leave them?
I think it leaves them in a really difficult position. You know, there is a big question mark about whether some of these upland farms can actually survive without the support of government schemes. This year, I mean, you know, a good number are going to have to, that's what they're going to be faced with, really, because they just lost that access to these schemes. I think a number of them were thinking that this might be for a relatively short period, a 12-month period before the scheme opened again in 2026. But, you know, with what's being rumoured at the moment, it does really beg those questions about whether there is going to be any reliable access to this funding going forwards. And if that's what they're facing, then I guess they've got no choice but to be looking at other income sources for their survival. And a lot of them in that case would turn their back on delivering for the environment because they won't be being paid for delivering for the environment. And that's a lose situation in my mind. You know, it really is. It's not helping us delivering to our environmental targets. And in many ways, those farmers will look more at production and farming enterprises to drive their income forward. And the balance and the harmony that I think a lot of us were hoping for will be lost. So it's going to be. And the other thing is that, you know, again, it is this matter of confidence and trust. You know, people have just not got a clue what's going on at the moment. It's a strange time in that some of our livestock prices are better than they've been for a long, long time, better than they've ever been in some ways, but there's still this real absence of confidence because of all this turmoil that's going on.
But we have had this week, haven't we, Phil, a £30 million boost, I think, as DEFRA referred to it, to HLS payment rates. So that is some good news. And when we consider that many of the people in those schemes were the early adopters who've really done a great deal of good, that is good news or not?
Well, it's not bad news, is it? I mean, any uplift in funding has got to be welcome, but it's not going to make the difference that we were hoping for. And to be honest, you know, this uplift is an uplift that should have happened a few years ago in response to inflationary costs, really. So it's not bad news, but it's not something that is going to be our salvation at all.
No, and I think the other thing is that we still need to understand how these people who are, if you like, imprisoned in these HLS schemes, how they're going to be able to move on to any new schemes, because I think most of these will expire, won't they, in the next couple of years?
They will, and again, it just raises a whole load of uncertainty, doesn't it? Most of these schemes will expire over these next couple of years, and now with all this going on, there's big question marks about the continuation and also the continuation of a scheme that makes the delivery of these environmental goods a viable option. So it leaves some huge question marks. So it is welcome. I have to say that, you know, when the 30 million uplift was being talked about a month or so ago, I was quite hopeful it would make a real meaningful difference. It sounds a lot of money, doesn't it? But, you know, when you see the analysis of what difference this is going to make, it's not what we'd hoped for.
And Phil, away from the turmoil of uncertainty and not knowing what's going to happen from one day to the other, what we do know is a whole load of you lot from the NSA and all your sheep farming friends are all heading to Penrith for North Sheep 25, is it?
We are. That's absolutely right. Next Wednesday on the 4th of June, that's where we're going to be. And despite all this turmoil, I can tell you there will be smiles on people's faces, because that's what sheep farmers are like. They will come together and they will have a moan. There will be concerns. But, you know, it will be a great event just to bring people together, the whole industry, you know, from the farmers and the vets and the advisors and all the trade that are involved with the sheep industry. There's going to be somewhere in the region of 220 trade stands there. So it's a big, big event. There's seminars going on through the day, some of which will cover the sorts of subjects that we're talking about now. You know, how do we deliver in the uplands good environmental outcomes from sheep farming? You know, what is the future of our hefted flocks? You know, there's going to be some great discussions going on, and there will be literally something for everyone, including, you know, what I think is going to be some fascinating farm tours around the estate with John and Liz Peel and their family. So it will be a great event. You know, despite all the turmoil that's going on, it'll be a great event.
That's Phil Stocker from the National Sheep Association. And if you want to know more about North Sheep 2025, Wednesday the 4th of June, simply visit nationalsheep.org.uk. Hugh, this speculation that funding is to be slashed, do you think it's a genuine leak, or do you think they've put it out there kite flying to see what the reaction is?
Kite flying or leaking? Well, in the past, Helena Horton from The Guardian, who wrote this piece, she's an environment reporter. She's put stuff out. It's like she's been throwing stuff by, you know, government officials and then chucked it out there as a bit of a, you know, like you say, balloon kite flying, dropping a stone in the pond and seeing how it ripples to see what the reaction is. But several people have said to me in the last 24 hours that this is a DEFRA, a leak from a disgruntled DEFRA employees. Now, if it's coming in that route, then it's not kite flying. And it could well be that's what's going to happen. Nothing's going to get funded much after 2026. Or if it is, it's going to be targeted at, I think the idea is small farms and not large, wealthy farms. So obviously, in the world of DEFRA, agro, socioeconomics, you can't be a wealthy small farmer or a poor large farmer. So yeah, who knows?
It does seem somewhat ridiculous in many ways, Louise, to suggest that funding is going to be directed towards small farms, but larger farms are not going to get as much. I mean, I get it to a certain extent, but nature doesn't decide between a small farm and a large farm, does it?
Well, no, it certainly doesn't. And nature doesn't respect boundaries at all either. I mean, I suppose we should probably say we are assuming that this is funding for nature recovery rather than just for keeping farmers in these areas. But it seems very strange to me. I mean, what are they going to do? Is all the nature going to get up and move and go to a place where it's going to be better looked after, if that's what they're proposing? That doesn't really seem right. Is a small farm decided on by its size, by its turnover, by the number of employees? How are we sort of defining that? What is a small farm versus a large farm? And the other thing I think about all of this, of course, is there has been, there is some work going on, nature recovery work on a landscape scale. So if you are then taking only a little bit of money and targeting in only certain areas, then what's going to happen to all that fantastic work that's done where people have, you know, come together and provided this connectivity for nature, which is so badly needed?
The government does seem to want farmers to do more and more and more when it comes to nature recovery, environmental enhancement, landscape protection, etc. And yet they're giving farmers less and less to do it with.
Well, they're just not going to do it, are they? I mean, you can't expect people to carry on doing what they've been doing. And let's face it, in a lot of cases, I know their income foregone schemes, for example, all the stuff that's happened with agri-environment, you know, field margins, wild bird plots and stuff like that. But in a lot of cases, the payments that they've been getting for those anyway, you know, you could argue they don't actually cover what's happening there in terms of loss of income and the time and the effort and the diesel burnt to plant things and do whatever. So I just think it's just not going to happen. You know, you can, people already are saying, well, if this is the case, the only way that I can survive is to intensify and push the farm a lot harder than I've ever done, because I can't afford to let these bits slacken off and not produce anything, as lovely as they are. And if it's about survival and survival of that business, then that's what they're going to do. Equally, some are just going to walk away, aren't they? Because they can't viably farm without that element of support in the system.
And going back to the beginning of the conversation with Phil Stocker-Louise, it does seem like it's one thing after another. The faster phase out of the basic payment scheme, the closure of the sustainable farming incentive to new applications, the suspension of capital grants, and now this.
Yeah, I know. It's just another turn, isn't it? I mean, Phil used the word chaotic, I think, didn't he? But I think another word that we could use about all this is conflicting as well. You know, on the one hand, they want farmers to go down a certain route, be more sustainable, provide for nature. And then on the other hand, they take away all that money or don't seem to realise how that money is being used. And, you know, as Hugh pointed out, when you go into one of these schemes now, the newer schemes, the SFI and what have you, there are time and costs associated with all of these actions. So you're not just being paid money for doing very little. You are really committing to this and spending money on the seed or, as you say, the fuel, whatever it might be. And the other thing I think, which I've really noticed, is how much farmers have been enjoying doing this work. And that's, you know, they've really got some job satisfaction out of this. So what a shame if all these rumours are correct, because I think we'd come really quite a long way. And now it looks as though we're just coming to a halt.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
At Avant, we crafted compact loaders for arable farming that transform the way you work. Our machines offer unparalleled versatility and efficiency, serving as your partners in productivity. With a wide range of attachments, Avant loaders assist in field preparation, crop care, and harvest activities. Their powerful hydraulics and compact design ensure smooth operation in tight spaces. Join the thousands of farmers who trust Avant for their best yields. Avant, innovation that works as hard as you do. Search for Avant now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, as you heard at the top of the podcast, the Hertfordshire farming family are quitting the UK to farm in France, where they say they face a better future. Joe Franklin and partner Rob Hodgkins are spending half term in Limoges with their three young children, signing documents and preparing for the big move. Earlier, I caught up with Joe during a lunch break while she was getting to grips with the French banking system, and she told me why they were leaving the UK.
A half-term break with a meeting with the French bank, and we've got to sign our documents to apply for our right to farm. So we're just down at the lake at the minute, and the kids have been digging and having lunch, and now we're off to the first farm to go and sign the right to farm. So it's, yeah, mix and match.
A big decision, Joe, not something that people do on a whim, moving to another country.
You probably think we thought about it harder than we actually really did. I guess we started talking seriously about it around Christmas time. We've looked at a few farms. We had an eye on Australia's, New Zealand's have kind of made pretty difficult to invest out there. And I'm not super sold on them. as being the right place to go. So we've just been having a look round, really, and found some good agents in France who've been extremely helpful. It's not the easiest thing to buy a big farm in France, but yeah, we've found a way.
A country notorious for its bureaucracy, Joe, how have you found the whole process?
There's a lot of red tape, but once you get farming, there's less red tape. So the entry is harder. But once you're here, I mean, there's no red tractor, for instance, no assurance. But everybody's been very positive, very helpful. Bank are extremely positive and helpful. They want more professional farmers. They want people, you know, we're bringing genetics, good, cheap genetics with us. What do I want to say? We're bringing progress to their farming industry, you know.
You seem almost to be saying, Joe, that already you feel more valued by the French government or the French system as a farmer than you do in the UK.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and all the people. You know, everybody cares what they eat here. Lunchtime is still an hour of your day where you sit down together. The children at school all sit and eat a three-course lunch together, which we would, you know, we've just looked around schools this week with the kids and they'd had carrot salad for starter, then they'd had steak, sauteed potatoes, and then strawberries and cream for pudding. We haven't seen anything like that offered to our children at school dinners, and it was about half the price of a UK school dinner. Everybody cares, don't they, about their food, and then so you've got everybody on your side.
So when's the big move then, Joe? When do you and Rob hope to be in France with the children permanently? Will you get there for this autumn?
No, it takes a long time because you have to apply for a right to farm, which takes about 4 months. And then you have to apply for your visas, which takes between 6 weeks and 12 weeks. So we will hope to be out there. 2nd of January is the big sign.
So you're pretty much selling up here completely, Joe. Can't take much with you. Got to leave the sheep at home in the UK too.
Yeah, so the dairy flock and the Romneys and the performance recorded Romneys, you know, we've got some very high-tech sheep, if you like, that we've invested heavily in and thoroughly believe in. And unfortunately, we can't take them. We'll take genetics. We'll get some genetics on ice and take them. And we've got, when you could export sheep, we have got some genetics. They're a bit old now, but we've got some genetics in Europe. So we hope to be able to buy from those customers to buy something back. But yeah, frustrating. So we need to make a good deal of selling these ones because buying them back is going to cost us a fortune out here at the minute.
That's Hertfordshire farmer Joe Franklin and partner Rob Hodgkins and their children making a new life for themselves this half term in France. Louise, you actually spoke to Joe a few weeks ago about the future of farming in England.
Yes, I have. And in fact, it was a piece done with 9 farmers all around the country, actually, asking them about what the future looked like for them. And Joe didn't actually tell me at the time that they were thinking about moving to France, but she did outline the fact that that their business model really just wasn't going to work when the schemes that they're in at the moment, so Countryside Stewardship and SFI, when they end, which I think is just in a couple of years' time, then she felt that they'd reached a barrier, I suppose. I mean, you know, technically, their technical performance on the farm is really very, very good. As she said, that their yields are just as good as everybody else's and their costs are lower. And they know that because they take part in these benchmarking initiatives and what have you. And actually, they are working all hours. You know, well, if they're not careful, they'll just be working all hours just to pay the rent. I mean, obviously, the costs of employing people have gone up and they had to let 2 people go because of that. She has looked at these private funding schemes and, you know, they've worked quite closely with water companies. They're also in the right area in Hertfordshire for Lens and for some of that funding. But she said, you know, those things come and go. They can't really rely on them, just the same as premium markets come and go. So she's tried, you know, milling wheats and growing specialist crops and all sorts. So I think she didn't really feel that they had a great option. You have to remember that I think they've got 27 landlords 27 different landlords. And with BPS going, most of their landlords were looking for some sort of a rent increase. And because they've got, you know, really quite numbers of sheep and they move them around on this land, with the fencing grants being suspended as well, the whole thing just wasn't really going to stack up for them and going to work, as I say, without them just having to work all hours that God sends just to pay the rent.
Moving house is difficult enough. Moving farm is a whole different ball game. Moving farm to another country, different again. There's a whole load of stuff that Joe and Rob can't take with them, including the sheep, Hugh. They're leaving the sheep behind.
Yeah, they are. I think probably because there's obviously blue tongue going on, but I think the main reason would be there's no border post to check. There's no live animals going into Europe from the UK. There hasn't been since Brexit, since we came out of the EU, because there's no actual border post to do veterinary checks to go in. So they were, before blue tongue, you could bring like heifers from Holland into the UK, but you couldn't take a Charolais bull or any animal for that matter from the UK into the EU. Obviously, blue tongue's come along and complicated it. But look, I don't blame these guys, you know. I mean, it's always quite exciting when you see some of the lovely farms in France. And I was saying earlier, I have this drip feed of chateaus. I don't know why it's chosen me, but on my Facebook feed, it's got these French-like big houses that are absolutely knackered. I mean, they have to have a fortune spent on them. And you can buy these giant castles for like 200 grand, and they look quite exciting and quite enchanting. I can see why they want to go. I totally get it. And the very best of luck to them, because there's some great opportunity out there, particularly if they really want to go at it in farm, because you know, the French have the advantage that most of their, I mean, certainly 2 years ago, they had not only the CAP money, but they had a member state contribution of circa 30% on top of that, something that we never had, even when we were in the CAP. We just got the Brussels check distributed and that was it. Oh, those were the days, weren't they? So they get that hike up as well. And plus all of the cultural things, and really exciting. We'll have to go out and see them once they get settled in.
Yeah, we will. This is exactly the sort of story that we want to be following. And Louise, exactly too, the sort of farmers that the UK as a country doesn't really want to be losing. Joe Franklin, Rob Hodgkins, both innovative farmers, entrepreneurial, both Nuffield scholars. I can understand what they're doing, but really and truly, sad to see them go. Not good to be losing some of our best and brightest British farmers.
No, that's not good. And I mean, they've always had this ambition to buy a farm. I mean, obviously, I think originally they hoped it was going to be in the UK, but that at the moment isn't an option for them. But yeah, no, I mean, Joe and Rob, they're both Nuffield scholars. I think actually that's how they met. Joe was a monitor farm. They've both done a lot of extra training. They've done that advanced farm business management course. I think Joe's even still studying at the moment at Cranfield, or was doing an MBA. So yeah, then, you know, we're sad to see them go. These are exactly the sort of young and hardworking people that we need in the industry. But I think everybody recognises and understands why they're doing what they're doing.
Upsides and downsides, though. No red tractor in France, Hugh, but lots of red tape.
Yeah, there's no shortage of that. I'm sure they've had people helping them. When you speak to people, it's all just the basic thing of buying the land and getting settled and going to see the Mari and sorting out the local mayor and all that joy. There's that to do, let alone all the other stuff that comes with it. Plenty of red tape still, I'm sure, around payments. And hey, they get payments. Wow, that'll be a novelty, won't it? And all of that. But, you know, I think it's a fantastic thing. It's a sad thing that they're leaving the UK. But for them, I think it's a great opportunity and something to be relished, you know, and I think, and culturally it's very different, isn't it? Particularly you get down where they're going to that Limousin region. It's lovely. You know, food is dead center of everything. Their country may be slightly more bankrupt than us, but they're still supporting their farmers and they're still putting food top dead center of everything they do. So the very best of luck to them.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast. The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us podcast@fwi.co.uk. And if you're in the UK itself, you can message us by texting the word farm, followed by your message to 88840. Louise, some big news this week. Confirmation that wheat varieties bred to be resistant to yellow rust are no longer resistant to the disease. A major winter wheat yellow rust resistance gene has failed. We suspected as much a month or so ago. Confirmation of that gene failure now reported by the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board. What does it mean for growers?
Yeah, well, what that means is that quite a few of the wheat varieties that are currently on the recommended list and quite a few of the popular ones that are grown widely around the country, the resistance rating that they have got really doesn't apply any longer. So what has been confirmed today is that it's the YR15 gene, which the pathogen has managed to overcome. Now, as you said, that is a major gene. That's major gene resistance. So that is a bit of a concern. When we talked about this before, we made mention of the fact that there were these two types of resistance, this seedling stage and the adult plant resistance. And we didn't know at that stage whether the adult plant resistance had been overcome as well as the seedling stage resistance. Well, we now know that it has. So yellow rust has continued to affect these varieties and affects some of them really quite badly. Of course, the only other sort of thing to really be aware of is that varieties have more than one resistance gene in them for these diseases. So it does slightly depend on their full genetic makeup as to how badly affected they are or aren't by yellow rust. But it's not really what we wanted to hear. I think farmers have got enough on their plates at the moment, and it looks like we've now got many more varieties that are susceptible to yellow rust than we thought we did at the start of the season.
So growers relying on that yellow rust resistance rating, on that yellow rust resistance gene, well, they can't rely on it any longer. It ain't necessarily so. Hugh, we've also reported in recent weeks on lack of rain, drought now declared in northwest England.
Yeah, drought in the northwest. Reservoirs revealing their secrets that have been submerged for nearly 100 years. Some of these, it's the classic sort of the Times picture story, isn't it? Of a reservoir and the remains of a village appearing. But really serious for the northwest, because normally it's the most wet sort of region of the UK, and their rainfall is massively, massively under par. Obviously, we've had some rain this last week, but nothing like what they would normally have. And the fact that these reservoirs are very empty and a drought's been declared, really worrying.
Yeah, worrying situation here too in East Anglia, and no drought yet. We have had some rain this week, a little rain at least, nowhere near enough to make a difference. Still looking at an early cereal harvest, and as grain fill approaches, that's going to impact on yields. That's what's going on in the field. Out of the field, though, another thing that is causing consternation is the number of high-profile people in agriculture that are changing jobs at the moment. Last week, we reported that Janet Hughes, DEFRA Farming and Countryside Director, was moving on. Well, since then, we've heard that Terry Jones, Director General of the NFU, is leaving his post. Also, Sandy Kapila of the Rural Payments Agency, after 13 and a half years, he's moving on too. Another civil servant that will be missed by the farming sector. Hugh, one person who is sticking around, Alistair McIntosh, Interim Chairman of Assured Food Standards, that's the Red Tractor Farm Assurance Scheme. Alistair McIntosh now appointed to that role on a permanent basis.
Yeah, Red Tractor really breaking the mould there and building confidence with their grower audience by appointing the interim chair. Not a lot to say about that really, other than it's a pretty... I'm going to be brutal. It's uninspired, and I think a lot of producers who we've been through the psychodrama with Red Tractor of the Green Initiative, then all the inquiries, all the money, all producers' money spent on it, NFU members' money, Red Tractor money. It's all been spent on these inquiries and everything else, and governance needs to be addressed. This needs to be sorted out. and we haven't moved on. It's like Groundhog Day. So I'm just lost for words about all of that, to be honest. And indeed, a heck of a lot of my colleagues are as well, because they were looking for something new and exciting, someone to lead it through, take it to the next level, because we need assurance. It's a really good system, but it needs an utter reinvigoration to get it moving and to get people believing in it again.
You can understand why, Hugh Louise, that some people are referring to this as part of the Kim Il-Jim regime. Jim Mosley, Chief Executive of Assured Food Standards, overseeing everything Red Tractor. Yes, Alistair McIntosh, the first farmer to be appointed chairman, but Alistair's got a job on his hands if he's going to show that things are changing for the better, that this isn't just business as usual, Louise.
Well, I have to admit that the farms that I've been on in the last few weeks who have just had their Red Tractor audit have all said, you know what, nothing has changed. It's just as awful as it ever was.
Some things staying the same then in terms of personnel. Other things are changing, Hugh.
Yes, lots of movements. Terry Jones, he's done 10 years as Director General. He's been at the NFU a lot longer from that. So fair play to him. I think given all that's going on, bless him, he fancies a bit of a change. So, yes, it's never a dull day in the world of land-based HR at the moment. Certainly revolving doors.
And Sandy Kapler at the Rural Payments Agency, Louise, he's going to be missed as well. Very much somebody willing to engage with farmers in much the same way that Janet Hughes has done at DEFRA.
Yeah, he is another person that the farmers are really going to miss. You know, he was another person that was prepared to engage, took time to understand where the problems were, if there were problems, and really wanted to get them solved. And he took on individual farmers' issues when, you know, they were hitting their heads against a brick wall. So that is a shame. Again, hopefully there are other very competent people who've been working for the RPA, someone who's very obvious who can fill those shoes, but they will be difficult ones to fill.
Lots of changes in the job market then. Some jobs, though, remaining the same. Hugh, the commodity markets, what sort of changes are we seeing there?
Thank you very much, Johan. Finished their dead weight this week, 678.3. That has come down. That's come down there, getting on for like 10p again on the week. If you go back last week, it was 687.9. Go back a year, 482.7. So it's still well over the average or the tracking average. If we look at the live weight, 374.1, that's gone up actually 2p on the live weight. To the sheep rings, and that's actually gone up, the SQQ dead weight this week. It's gone up quite a bit, about 80p, 753 dead is this week's SQQ dead weight for sheep. The live weight, 348.3, that's dropped back about 4p on the week. Pig price, 206.7, so that's gone up half a penny on the week. And to the arable market, there is a vague, it's pretty pathetic, really. It's not really an inkling of cheer. It's a pound and 50p here and there. Feed wheat, 162.4. That is up £2.40 on the week. Milling week is 178.70. That is up a massive 70p on the week. There you go. That'll sort your farm margin out. Feed barley, £151.70. That's gone up about £2 on the week. Oilseed rape is up £4, £434 dead. Feed peas, £212.70, that's up £3 on the week. Feed beans, £222.30, that is also up £3 on the week. If you are buying diesel this week, as we predicted last week, with a slumping crude market, the red diesel price has dropped nearly another penny this week. The Wednesday morning ring round revealed that you should be paying about 62.35 pennies per litre of red diesel.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, here's some special news. Thursday, the 5th of June, National Sausage Roll Day. A special day of celebration for the pork and pastry snack. Sales are soaring, with bakery chain Greggs saying it sells 1 million sausage rolls every day. And to celebrate, a special sculpture of a sausage roll will go on display this month at Madame Tussauds Waxworks Museum in London, alongside celebrities such as Sir David Attenborough, Shakespeare and Stormzy. So is this a clever marketing ploy, or are sausage rolls really flying out of the doors of cafes and bakeries? Well, market research company Kantar says bakery sales of pork-based products rose 8.3% last year, despite a 6.6% price increase. Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board Consumer Insight Analyst Alicia Zane.
It is quite unusual. I think it's not what we would typically see, but it's not exactly unexpected because sausage rolls have been doing quite well. And it's not just sausage rolls, actually. We're also seeing the same performance across products that are quite similar to sausage rolls, actually. So one of the things that we look at AHDB, or one of the markets that we look at, is the food service market. And this includes, well, different food service channels, such as full service restaurants, and that means dine in. We look at quick service restaurants, such as fast food joints and stuff. But most importantly, one of the channels that we look at is cafes and bakery channels. And this includes, well, bakeries, sandwich, as well as salad shops. And the thing is that these channels, the cafes and bakery channels, have remained quite resilient in the food service market in 2024. And this is really beneficial for pork, actually. And we can really see it quite clearly, because pork is heavily, heavily overtrading in this channel. And it's making up 42.5%. of all pork dish volume sales in the food service market alone. And one of the dishes that's doing quite well includes, yeah, of course, sausage rolls. And it's not just that, it's also the same thing for bacon butties and other pork-based pastries as well.
Many of us do indeed like sausage rolls, Alicia, not just from Greg's, but other bakeries too, Gale's, independent shops. They are selling well. This 8.3% year-on-year increase in volume of sales, despite this 6.6% price increase, as popular as ever. People are still buying them.
They really are still buying them, and it's doing really well, as you can see, because while 6.6% is... it is a price hike, but is considered quite moderate. And more importantly, consumers are willing to absorb that price hike, because sausage rolls, it's something that's quite versatile, quite practical, and really convenient for consumers, because it really is the perfect meal when you just want to have something to grab and go, or you just want something as a snack, which is really convenient for, say, people who are working and they just want something to grab and have it at the office. So what this means is that consumers are more than willing to accept this this really moderate price increase, as long as the product really meets their need for convenience.
Alicia Zane from the AHDB, thank you. Hugh, sausage rolls flying off the shelves.
Well, it just shows how popular they are. Yeah, I'm not a big sausage roll fan, but it doesn't surprise me at all. And particularly, actually, it's the food on the go thing that I think is really, when you look at the expansion, and I'm thinking specifically here of Greg's, and I know they're a bit about this story with the Madame Tussauds thing, that expansion and what they've invested and the investment that they've got into that business over the last 10 years is quite, I mean, it's really impressive. And when you look where they've put these little shops in the sides of garages, they've done JVs with garage chains, they've done all sorts to get those in. Yeah, people are time poor, obviously still cash rich, because they can afford to pay for pork snacks and treats, even though they're up, what is it, 16, 18% up on retail value. So yeah, it's just a reflection of our busy city urban lifestyles and the fact that we can slip in a sausage roll whilst we're on the move.
Louise, sausage roll for you, or more of a steak bake?
Do you know, I've never actually been to a Greg's, but perhaps we shouldn't really admit that now. But I'm not sure which one of those I would go for. I've seen the sort of publicity around this, well, around the Madame Tussauds bit, that the price of a sausage roll in Greg's has gone up from £1 to £1.30. But of course, that's really still pretty good value, isn't it, compared to the cost of some of the other snacks and compared to the cost of buying a takeaway coffee now. So, what are they saying? It's a national treasure, aren't they?
Yeah, a national treasure alongside the likes of Sir David Attenborough, Shakespeare and Stormzy. The sort of iconic cultural status that we can only hope for here on the Farmers Weekly podcast. Well, that's about it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We do hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. If you have, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please do, as always, leave us a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with all the latest news, views and analysis of all the biggest stories in UK agriculture. But for now, until next week, I'm Johan Tasker.
I'm Louise Impey.
And I'm Hugh Broome.
Thank you for listening.